The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, July 13th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Kellyanne, I'm not going to take the bait. I know what you're trying to do. Okay, I'm taking the bait. There she was, on the TV again, offering insight and analysis.
So I just want to review, in case you run out of time. This is how I see it so far. This is to help all the people at home. What's the conclusion? Collusion? No. We don't have that yet. I see illusion and delusion.
Chuckling in the background there is journalist and truth seeker Sean Hannity. It was on his show that Kellyanne continued.
So just so we're clear, everyone, four words. Conclusion, collusion, no. Illusion, delusion, yes. I just thought we'd have some fun with words.
But why stop the fun there? Kellyanne's conclusion that collusion's an illusion. Kellyanne concluded deludedly. She's not even making an allusion to the infusion of a profusion of contacts with agents of the former Soviet Union. A jury in seclusion might find fault with the profusion of Russians not even warranting Form SF-86 inclusion. I might need a quick transfusion to treat this newly formed contusion after I smack my head in disillusion. This is Lin-Manuel Miranda meets Dr. Seuss. On the show today, I spiel about, well, I feel the rhythm. I got the rhythm of the White House. I'm going to talk about musicians who are counseling Trumps. But first, to the high C. No, not the green-colored sugary fruit juice, though wouldn't that be delicious? To the briny depths of the ocean blue. Who controls the sea controls destiny, says my guest, retired Admiral James Stavridis. He's written a book on the ocean and has lots of relevant insight into today's military challenges. The sea, she is at once a harsh mistress and the lungs of the earth. She is vast and unknown, yet at the same time, there's more of it than there is of us. Even within us, there's more of it, water, than there is, you know, dry stuff. Who controls the sea controls history, as detailed in an ocean-by-ocean account, Sea Power, the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. It's written by Admiral James Stavridis, retired admiral. He was, the credentials. Commander U.S. Southern Command, Commander U.S. European Command, NATO Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, and the first naval officer to hold those three positions. He's now the dean at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. Hello, Admiral Stavridis. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. It's great to be with you.
How long have you gone, if you add it all up, how long have you gone without seeing land in your life?
If you add it all up, I've spent over 11 years on the deep ocean out of sight of land. The longest I've ever been at sea without seeing land for a given stretch was just over 6 months.
What's that do to you?
It gives you a lot of time to read and write and think.
Oh.
And it also gives you a lot of space to contemplate and to think through your life. There's something magical about being on the oceans. Here's the bad news. You're away from your family. And I can't count the number of birthdays and anniversaries and Christmases I've missed. So like everything in life, it's a balance. At the end of the day, I'm happy with the balance that I struck. But I did spend a lot of time in the deep ocean.
Is there in the Navy a maximum that is considered, if you go past this point, either the sailors or logistics or whatever can become frayed? Let's not go past this red line in terms of number of days out at sea.
I think generally we try very, very hard to get our ships into port every 45 days, about every month and a half. We occasionally have to keep a ship out 6 months. That's very rare. And occasionally we'll have a cruise where you're going in and out of port, but you're gone from your home port for 7, 8, 9 months. Occasionally that stretches to a year. But there's no absolute red line. These naval forces are utterly flexible. I'll tell you an interesting sidelight to this is submarines. Often people say, well, how long can a submarine stay underwater? What's the limiting factor? Is it water? Nope, they can make their own water. Is it propulsion? Nope. They've got nuclear reactors. Is it air, oxygen? Nope. They can make their own oxygen. The limiting factor is food for the crew. We carry enough food in a submarine for a submarine to stay down below for about 90 days. After that, you know, we could keep it a little longer. It'd be like being on the spa when they came home. They'd be a lot skinnier. We can stay at sea a long time in all these ships.
Yeah, I think I was saying to myself, oh, yeah, I know that. And then I'm like, wait a minute. Maybe just from watching Das Boot do I know that. One of the great naval films, halfway in, you're like, wait a minute. Am I rooting for the Nazis? What's going on here?
It's a great movie.
Yeah. I know you write that naval battles are hinges and the great doors of history swing on these hinges. I want to ask you a question about that, but could you give me a couple examples?
I can. I'll give you one from a long time ago. So this is 2,500 years ago. The Persians, who we know as the Iranians today, are about to invade and decimate the free small city-states of Greece, notably Athens. Athens puts together a kind of a catch-as-catch-can fleet and goes to sea to a place called Salamis, just off of Athens, and destroys the Persian fleet. If the Persians had won that battle, we'd probably have a very different evolution of history, certainly in Europe and therefore here in the United States. Coming a little closer, let's go to the Battle of Trafalgar off of Spain in the early 1800s when Napoleon is threatening to invade Great Britain. I would say it's not a stretch to say that if the British under Vice Admiral Lord Nelson had not won the Battle of Trafalgar, you and I could be conducting this interview in French today.
Yes.
So little hinges, they swing big doors. Those sea battles, and there are many in history, are very indicative of that.
Yes. But here's my question. Obviously, there are lots of critical battles in history, and some percentage of them are going to be sea battles. And people who understand the oceans, even in a rudimentary fashion, know that they're important. And if you shut blockades in the Civil War, and if you shut down the oceans, it will affect all other aspects of military and society. But do you think they're disproportionately important in terms of either the number killed or when set against all other important battles in war?
Certainly, in terms of numbers killed, they're much smaller. At the Battle of Stalingrad, a famous land battle in the Second World War, 2 million people died in the course of about a year. No naval battle in history remotely looks like that. It's tens of thousands at most. But in terms of a disproportionate effect on, if you will, clashes of civilization, yes, I think you can make the case that again and again in history, we find these crucial battles that occur at sea, out of sight of land, and yet they have enormous disproportionate impact on geopolitical events.
So that brings me to the current so-called war on terror. And there is no signature naval battle of that conflict. It could be for a lot of reasons, and maybe one of the reasons is that we just haven't seen it yet. But might that lead one to conclude that maybe that conflict is not as civilization changing as, you know, it's purported to be, just by the very dint that when there are civilization changing battles, there's usually some naval component to it?
I agree completely. And in fact, I think as a geopolitical muscle movement, the quote, war on terror, unquote, is not a crucial example. We are not seeing a sweeping conflict between two great states. We're not seeing a clash of civilization. We're really seeing the use of a tool. Terror is only a tool. We're seeing the use of that tool in the hands of, I think, relatively small numbers of fanatics. I don't see that as apocalyptic. I don't even see it as particularly influential. And over the long course of history, the thing to watch in this century is going to be the rise of China, the rise of India, the resurgence of Russia, and how the United States responds to those events. And I assure you, there will be a significant maritime component in each of them.
How do you foresee, you know, define the war? Will it be the somewhat militaristic, but also more of a trade rivalry that the United States sees now with China? Or might it get hot, like over Syria, U.S. planes shooting down Syria planes, Russia coming back saying that could be us fighting next time?
Yeah, I think as you look around the world today, the good news is that although we have a great deal of high-end competition that verges on military, particularly with Russia and China, the good news is that we do have diplomatic tools. We have vastly better communications paths. We have international organizations like the United Nations, where nations can pound the table at each other instead of firing artillery shells at each other. So I think the odds are low that we're going to see a hot war in any of these regions that we've talked about. But I assure you, our naval forces will be banging against each other in the South China Sea, in the Arctic, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the Black Sea. They'll be shouldering each other, surveilling each other. What we need to do is ensure that these zones of competition don't become real zones of conflict, and the battle space will be at sea.
Is the nature of conflict these days such that the Navy is more tail than tooth, more getting the than it has been, more getting the supplies to the fighters than it has been, as opposed to conducting the fight?
No, I don't think so. If you look at power projection, which is what you're talking about, the ability to go ashore and conduct strikes and influence events, we use those 12 aircraft carriers endlessly. The recent shootdown of the Syrian jet over Syria was done by a Navy plane operating from the carrier Bush in the Eastern Mediterranean. Likewise, Marines, they go ashore, but their base, their weapon systems, all their support comes from those big deck amphibs, including the aircraft that support them that are designated for the Marine Corps. Tomahawk missiles, we have thousands and thousands of them in the inventory in submarines, cruisers, destroyers. There is enormous offensive capability in the Navy. But again and again, when there's a crisis, the President of the United States, his first question is, where are the carriers? Because they are flexible and they can strike.
Okay, let's go through, because you have expertise in all these areas. So let's start with Qatar.
Sure.
ISIS, we touched on it, but do they have any real naval power? What should we worry about the Islamic State? We talked about terrorism in general, but what should we worry about the seafaring capabilities of the Islamic State?
What we ought to worry about is if they decide to pursue maritime operations. So we often say that 9/11, which was an air attack, correct, was not a failure of intelligence. It was a failure of imagination. We need to imagine what if the Islamic State decided, for example, to go after a massive cruise liner using what they do in marketplaces, a truck bomb, putting it on some kind of a coastal ghost freighter, pulling it up alongside the Queen of the Seas cruise liner and blowing it up. There's 6,000 people on some of those cruise liners. You could easily lose them all in a big enough explosion. Or they could use a series of small boat attacks like Al-Qaeda did against USS Cole in Yemen. You may remember that. Blew a hole in the side of a Navy destroyer, killed 17 sailors, $300 million worth of damage. I am surprised that the Islamic State has not gone to a maritime option, and I am fairly certain they will over time. They've done air, they've done plenty on the ground. I think it's only a matter of time until they use maritime approaches.
Let's talk about H.R. McMaster. You were very complimentary of him when he took his job in national security, right?
I was. I just to give you my background with H.R., I've known him since he was a mid-grade officer. When I was the Supreme Allied Commander and had responsibility for Afghanistan, I needed brilliant one-star officer to take on corruption in Afghanistan. I could have picked any admiral or general in the armed forces. I chose H.R. McMaster.
Yeah. In his press conference explaining what the president disclosed to the Russians and talking about characterizing that, well, because the president said it wouldn't have been illegal, but then I would say in general, he expressed and gave his blessing for what was said and told the media that there was nothing untoward going on. Do you think that he wound up spending down some of his credibility with those statements?
I do indeed. And I think every day that he stays in the White House is a challenge because of the sort of disjointed nature of how the system is trying to respond to a president who acts in extremely unconventional ways. And so H.R. McMaster wrote a book, a famous book, Dereliction of Duty, about the failure of the Joint Chiefs, the admirals and generals in the Vietnam War, to speak truth to power. And I think that for H.R. to really succeed in that job, he's going to have to speak more truth to power and not take on the job of cleanup after a presidential mistake, which the conversation with the Russians clearly was a presidential mistake.
A lot of people looked at that and expressed disappointment and to some degree or another called him a hypocrite and said he's hurting his reputation. But I think you could look at it another way, which is that a military man, which I am not, but you are, says that you have to make sacrifices at some point. And he knowingly and willingly sacrificed something that was very important to him, which is a part of his reputation, because perhaps, you know, I'm getting in his head, but because the bigger picture is the very reason he took this job, to stand as a bulwark, perhaps against the excesses of what could go wrong in the Trump administration.
I think you are exactly right. And I'll simply add to it and expand the conversation to say two other officers who are very, very close friends of mine, peers, General John Kelly over at DHS and General Jim Mattis over at Defense, I think are in exactly the same boat. They're not quite on the bridge of the boat along with HR and the president, but they're down in the engine room driving around, and they are facing those same kind of challenges. And they're willing to stay in those jobs as a service to the country because it could be so much worse if they weren't in those jobs. And I agree with them.
The president has essentially given the generals, and this is the Secretary of Defense, but the other generals, and the Secretary of Defense, Mattis, is now a civilian. That is correct?
Correct.
Yeah, but McMaster is still on active duty. Am I right about that?
That's correct also.
Okay, so he's given the generals essentially the ability to write their plan for Afghanistan, Iraq. The generals, the admirals, the military officers have more of a say in this than probably they've ever had in U.S. history. Now, some will say, given how much the president seems to understand about these situations, that's good. We have the smartest people running the job, given the alternative. On the other hand, what about the precedent that this sets for future administrations where we've taken a very important job out of civilian hands and given it to the military? Do you worry about that?
I do. And I think you've categorized it correctly. This is something that makes tactical sense in the moment to do it, given President Trump's utter lack of knowledge about these issues, as well as the vast knowledge of someone like General Mattis. So it kind of makes tactical sense, but I think it's strategically dangerous for the long haul. What you don't want is an America in which there is even a shred of diminution of civilian control of the military. That's bedrock. And believe me, we in the military feel that is bedrock. So I'm worried about it. I think it's okay tactically, but I certainly hope that the White House maintains strategic control, making the big decisions, because only an elected leader should have the power to send our young men and women into harm's way.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis is currently the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. His book is Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Pleasure to talk with you.
What a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And now the spiel. In the White House, lawyers be having lawyers, so it shouldn't be a surprise that the children and associates of children and children of associates have lawyers too. Donald Trump Jr.'s new lawyer is Alan Futterfus. Now, I tried to figure out how it was pronounced on my own. It could be Futterfus or Futterfass. I called the law offices. Futterfus. Here's a Washington Post description of what Futterfus does. As an undergraduate, he attended the Juilliard School in Manhattan, where he studied bass trombone. He graduated in 1984 and continues to play the instrument in the Park Avenue Chamber Symphony, has performed at Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center, and played a 9-day tour in China. Whoa! Bass trombone! That is really interesting. So he was hired because he does have loads of experience in white-collar law, and he defended members of the Lucchese and Colombo crime families, and he also worked closely with Donald Trump's lawyer, Gerard Schegel. But it's mainly because he, like other members of the Trump legal team, is a gifted musician. Jay Sekulow has been on a number of the shows. He's Donald Trump's lawyer who tries to get him out of trouble when he tweets. He's the one who got into it with Chris Wallace over the president admitting he was under investigation. And Sekulow trying to say, no, this was if I were under investigation, injecting some words. But that's not the only thing that Jay Sekulow injects. He injects red hot rock riffs. Here is Spin Magazine describing him. A musical polymath who plays drums and guitars in a group that also includes Christian rock singers John Schlitt of the band Petra and John Elefante, who used to be the lead singer of Kansas. Wow! Here is a tasty Sekulow pinned number called Through the Years. Tell me where we were when he placed the stars up in the sky. Who warms the eagles as they fly? You thought it was going to be God. No, he's talking about Donald Trump. Actually, it is God. So we've got Footerfist on the slush pump. We've got Sekulow on the skins. Sure, Sekulow can wield the axe too. But for that, we go to the chief White House counsel, Don McGahn. Don McGahn is a guitarist and sometimes singer for the Ocean City, Maryland-based cover band called Collusion Delusion. No, I'm just kidding. They're called American Carnage. No. He fronts fake news in support of their new LP. Nobody knew rocking out would be so complicated. Okay, that's all a lie. His band is, or was, he quit the band, but it was called Scott's New Band. Exciting. Here they are, ladies and gentlemen. Don't stop believing. Actually, in that part, he was on the keyboards. Now, listen to McGahn's Neil Schon-esque shredding. Okay, we got Sekulow on drums, McGahn on guitar, Footerfist on trombone. We could use some bottom, you know, some bass. Maybe Mark Kasowitz plays bass. I'm not familiar with any White House lawyers who actually play bass. But what I was trying to do is flesh out the horn section. And wouldn't you believe it? Remember how last week we reported how Jamie Gorelick represented the Kushners? She was a member of the 9/11 Commission, one of Washington's top lawyers. She's getting some fuss because she's, you know, a Hillary Clinton ally, Jamie Gorelick. Well, I was thinking about Jamie Gorelick. And, you know, Gorelick, that word, that name starts with a G. And you know who else's last name starts with a G? Doesn't just start with a G, is only a G. It's Kenny G. That alone would qualify. But you know what the G in Kenny G stands for? It's Gorelick. Kenny Gorelick and Jamie Gorelick. Are they related? It doesn't matter. Like any good lawyer will tell you, don't ask a question you don't want to know the answer to. That is enough for me. We have just created a super band. I will channel Don McGahn and I will not stop believing that a White House supergroup could conceivably rope Kenny G in to sit in on a session. And then this, all of this, all these emoluments and foreign actors and collusion, all of this will have been worth it. That's it for today's show. On the What Ocean Are You quiz, GIST producer Mary Wilson turned up she's a Pacific, expansive yet calm. GIST producer Chris Berube wound up being an Atlantic, on average, the saltiest major ocean. Steve Lichtai, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, is an Arctic, insofar as Fridtjof Nansen was the first to make a nautical crossing of him. The GIST, The quiz show that we are the Indian Ocean, in that a vortex of plastic garbage measuring 1.9 million miles is constantly circulating within us. Umpuru depuru du puru, and thanks for listening.